Ahoy, ahoy. Welcome to Head Games, the science and psychology of sports. I'm Dr. Brett Levine, joined as always by Dr. Ben Rosenberg. Well, we have a guest today. We are not getting Zoom bombed, I don't think. our guest today is Booker T. Harris. He's the coach of Dominican University men's basketball team. Booker played three seasons for the USF Dons and was a member of the WCC Tournament Championship team in 1998. He's worked with a number of Division I and Division II programs, including Metro State, University of San Diego, Cal State San Bernardino, Cal State Long Beach, and Sonoma State. And you helped coach and develop NBA power forward Ivan Johnson, which is also pretty cool. Booker, welcome to Head Games.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks, Ben, Brett. Thanks for having me. So I'm on with the two doctors talking a little bit basketball and teamwork stuff. So who's more like Dr. J?
If only I had that kind of hook shot. I used to have a good jumper when I was younger, but it's kind of inconsistent these days.
I got a couple assists from you in that game, Ben. So you made me look good. Like I still had it.
You were banging threes, man. Don't be modest.
we should clarify. These two are coworkers. So Ben is a professor at Dominican and Booker is the coach of Dominican basketball. And I heard off air that you guys played in a students versus faculty game last year before being next to other people was illegal. How was that? I heard you guys lost though.
We did. It was close though. It's a, you know, the thing about it, it's a young person's game. I can definitely say our cardiovascular was nowhere near those young people. Like, it's amazing when you're out there and in your mind, you think you're moving at a certain pace and speed. And the reality is like slow-mo. I was like, oh, yeah.
I think it's especially when you're used to doing something in a certain way, right? Like, I did not obviously play basketball at the level you played, but I played basketball my whole life. So you're used to being able to cut and move and tell your body to do things in a certain way. And like, particularly if you don't play consistently, which I don't, like, you're just a step slow, man. It's like, oh, I can get to that ball. Nope, can't get to that ball.
Oh, that's like me in practice sometimes. Those who can't do anymore, they yell. The coach, actually. So it's amazing. It's like, don't hurt yourself when you're trying to demo this drill. Just catch the ball on this pass.
Yeah.
The interesting thing too about that game we played is I thought stylistically, right? The students only shot threes. I don't know if they made a single 2-point field goal the entire game. It was they're like leaning into the analytics thing in basketball, like only shoot threes as much as you can. And we pretty much only shot twos because Jordan is like 6'6" or something. He's just like getting buckets at the rim.
That's right. So the kids know three is worth more than two. So I think you're right. It seemed like every single shot they made was a three. Nothing else. No mid-range game. It's a lot.
No mid-range game. Seriously, man. What's that about?
I want to hear more about some stories, especially from your playing and your coaching career. This is quite a resume, right? A lot of different programs, and you've been at Dominican for, I think, this is your 10th season?
Yeah, believe it or not, as a head coach, that's time flew by, and it definitely does age you. So I'm pretty grateful and realize, you know, I'm in a blessed position to have a head coaching job for 10 years. And like you mentioned before, I started playing the game at a young age and was able to play through high school for my dad, which helped with the green light and getting a lot more shot attempts than everybody else. But on the flip side, when you're able to sneak into the gym and have a key to the gym, it's one of those places you kind of earn your stripes. And as you mentioned before, Brett, you know, University of San Francisco, and was able to play on a NCAA tournament team who lost in the first round to University of Utah with who had three NBA guys.
Was that the Van Horn, Andre Miller team?
Andre Miller, Michael Doliak was in the middle. Doliak. I want to say Hanno Mattola was on that team. Oh, man.
Throwbacks.
So Keith Van Horn had just graduated. But I think we were their closest game until they lost in that national championship game.
Wow. Andre Miller was still in the league until like yesterday, right?
Right. Yes. Actually, yes. To play that long and to be that savvy, it goes to show you, you know, how wisdom in old age and experience to teach all those younger guys goes a long way. And when you think about the NBA game now, like how many of those young players, if they stayed in college, would be like seniors. So it'd be, it's amazing to see and crazy.
Yep. Can you talk a little bit more about your journey? Like, what are some of the things that really impacted you and going from, like you said, playing for your dad to USF to all these different coaching stops to ending up at Dominican?
I was born and raised in San Francisco. So University of San Francisco was close to home. I remember as a fourth grader for like CYO in junior basketball night, going to see them play like Pepperdine, I think. And it might've been like Doug Christie was on that Pepperdine team. And it was one of those, my first college game ever. So it was quite the experience. And that kind of like stuck with me. And the ability to stay close to home for me at that point in time was important, being around the family, which was big, and had a younger brother who played there also after me. So it was just one of those things where I was comfortable at the time, you know, staying close to home. I mean, obviously it became a little bit different story as you get into the business of coaching in college and you're trying to take any opportunity. And for me, not being married or having kids, I was able to kind of pick up and go, you know what I mean? Like just load up the Honda Civic, throw four duffel bags in there and figure it out, whether it's sleeping in the office or crashing, couch surfing with the other coaches or your family. Just being around the game, it's one of those things I kind of didn't want to go into like a 9-to-5 office job. And I had thought about, you know, selling insurance and using my business degree and my MBA, which I actually did wind up getting also, completing it, you know, at Sonoma State. But it was one of those things in college athletics, you know, there's only a certain amount of universities and positions in it. So it's really competitive. Mm. So making those decisions to go to a different university or move on, like I said, I didn't know if it would be the right decision, but it was a good decision for me to kind of have more responsibility and learn from different people, just because I was around so many different head coaches that taught differently and a lot of similarities also. But I took bits and pieces from every spot that I was at and kind of tried to apply it to my own coaching style, which I learned right away, like chapter one, know thyself in a sense. like I wasn't going to be Phil Matthews, who I played for, or Bill Greer or Jeff Oliver or Coach Scaldo at Sonoma State, and Brandon Hayes and Derek Clark at Metro State. But from each one of those stops, it was great relationships with the players at the time, especially as an assistant, because they'll ride in your van, they'll talk to you. You're not as far as like the head figure where they're like, oh, I can't talk to that guy, or I'm upset at him because he didn't play me. And like I said, that's probably the biggest thing now as far as being the head coach, the decisions on daily statting practices and, you know, trying to be, you know, pretty subjective. And it's one of those things where I love using, you know, stats, and we have this program called Synergy that gives this analytics that allow us to see over game time, like what people are shooting from different spots on the floor and the turnover ratio and things like that. So I guess the long-winded answer, as I should be trying to maybe land the plane in a sense, is like I still wanted to be around the sport. I was competitive. And then most importantly, I just enjoyed being around that team atmosphere and the relationships and the bond that you get with those guys. So,
yeah.
I love how you said, like, through your coaching career, you picked up these little nuggets. And it kind of sounds like you didn't want to be this tapestry of just pieces that you picked up, but you picked some up that really felt, at least the way you described it, that matched you, that matched your style. So how would you describe like your philosophy and your coaching style now?
You know, I'd like to always think that I was like a player's coach, seeing it from the point of view as a player, you know, as far as being out there on the floor and the game, the speed of the game. But I do rely on like what they're seeing out there on what's going on. I'm big on teaching and repetition, because the mother of all skill, you know, is repetition in a sense. Understanding you've been in that scenario, going through different situations and practice and scrimmages that you can apply when it happens to game time. So it's almost like that deja vu feeling, or even big on like visualizing and seeing things before they happen and watching film and breaking that down too. And like I said, also a little bit coming from like my family. My mom was a daycare preschool teacher. I had my brother also works in the junior college level. So he coaches and teaches. So it's one of those things where I'm also aware and trying to get better at my own teaching methodology, you know, say it, see it, and then have you show me what you've just learned. So kind of similar and a little bit different to, you know, how it is when we were growing up, you know, per se, as far as the coach at that point in time. Like, I didn't ask questions. It was like, what coach says, you go ahead and do it. And like nowadays, it's more one of those things like the student athletes and the players, they want to feel some ownership or involved with it. And the trust factor has to be built through, I guess, like genuine relationships and conversation, knowing that you care about them. So, I mean, obviously they pick the university or come play for you because they do want to continue playing. But now it's a little bit different. They don't walk in there and like, you read my resume, but I don't even know if it even matters to some people. Hmm. You know what I mean? Because compared to Steve Kerr's or Michael Jordan's, like mine was nowhere near that, you know, as a college basketball player. You know, I was one of those guys who pushed guys in practice and tried to take advantage of the opportunity that I got when I was in a game. And at the end of the day, I know it doesn't work out for everybody, but I was lucky enough playing the NCAA tournament and cut down the nets and beat Gonzaga before they got going on their 20 something year run. And then as an assistant coach, you know, at University of San Diego, beating Gonzaga, beating UConn in the first round of the NCAA tournament, being a part of that staff, and at Metro State and San Bernardino, NCAA tournament runs, and losing at the buzzer in a national semifinal game. All that stuff is, you know, been amazing to be a part of, and realizing how difficult that is. Like, it's one of those things, like I said, my brother played at USF also after me, and they didn't make it to the NCAA tournament. I was on the last team that had done that. And, you know, before the Dandy Dons had great runs, Bill Russell, Casey Jones, Bill Cartwright, Quentin Daly, Winford Boynes, players like that.
Yeah. So you talked a little bit about this building this trust factor with your players. And that seems like a really important thing to you in terms of your coaching philosophy, as you said. How do you go about doing that? I mean, it sounds like you're pretty intentional in the way that you cultivate those relationships with your players. Like, do you have any tried and true methods, or is it just conversation? Like, how do you go about building that trust?
Conversation and daily interaction. It's one of those things where they want the same guy every day. And it's one of those things where in between those lines on the court, like, I'm pretty intense and deliberate and on you. But once we walk out, it's like I'm one of the no, I'm still a old fuddy-duddy to them, but I'm one of those cooler coaches that they can sit back and conversate and know that I care about them. So, like you said, it is one of those things of being intentional and aware. And at the end of the day, explaining to them, like, although it was many moons ago, like, I do empathize with what you're going through. I know your body's hurting, but you have way more better availability to treatments and stuff than I did in that training room with like Normatec recovery, like massage guns, you name it. For me, it was like, here, take this ibuprofen, jump in this cold tub. Yeah. And if I really wanted to treat myself at home, my mom would send me some Epsom salt and I'd pour it in there. So
you've talked about the coach that you've become. What are some of those, I guess, tactics or skills as a coach that you either said, that's not me, or ones that you aspire to, like in the future, when you talk about when the game's on between the lines, you want to be a certain way, or after the game, you'd want to be a certain way?
I'd say probably, you know, sweat equity with them when you're in practice. Like if it's one of those things where on occasion I have hopped in, you know, a couple drills or 4-minute scrimmages. I'm puffing and puffing. But I think they respect the fact that I'm trying to do it with intensity and play hard. Kind of like the whole thing of now it's a little bit different because it's air high fives and touches and fist bumps. But before, it was one of those things where I was trying to be like Steve Nash. And I'm sure you guys have heard, like, I think they did some study where he had a ridiculous amount of high fives and interactions with his teammates when he was in Phoenix and probably wherever he was, that type of deal. And so it's one of those things where I learned, you know, just hanging with those guys off the court, whether it's stopping by Caloriga, the cafeteria, to go eat with them, long road trips in our conference. We play in Hawaii. in Southern California before. We used to play in Arizona and Utah. So when you're in your van ride, stopping for lunch, joking with them, and then not taking the game so seriously, as far as when mistakes happen, it's one of those things. I try not to necessarily go berserk or freak out in practice when Ben throws the ball away, because everyone saw that he had a turnover and mom and dad are there. So it's like, here you go, move on to the next play. But if it keeps happening, it's come sit next to me right here on this, this pine. but like I said, players, you earn your trust by what you do day in and day out. And so one of those things, they kind of have a longer window of trust and being able to play through the mistakes compared to where you're at. You know, maybe as a freshman, there's not that because you haven't been in the program and you don't know the expectations or how you should play. Like when you first walk through that door, like, no, it's great that you're playing hard, but we all play hard. That's just getting your foot in the door. So you don't want them to get confused for activity, for achievement, because you still do have to produce, you know, in that point in time.
Yeah.
What does it take to make the NBA?
What does it take to make the NBA?
I've got aspirations, man. I know school's over. I'm just looking for, you know, the next step.
Well, Brett, I hope you have a good financial advisor so you could buy a team. being an owner. Being an owner, that's a great route. I mean, those guys love you and hang around. But, you know, to make the NBA, it takes an extreme amount of dedication to your craft. Extreme physical skills, because let's be honest, like a lot of those guys at the NBA level are great athletes. And then the ones who aren't great athletes, they're a specialist in what they do, like knockdown shooter. The thing that I always try to tell my guys is you see guys who were even superstars or the man in college, and when they come into the NBA, they become role guys. Like if you really think about it, how many all-stars or superstars are there in the NBA compared to all those spots?
Yeah.
So it's one of those things too, you know, it's a business. So it's timing of having the right person to give you a look or give you a tryout, especially if you're not a quote unquote lottery pick. But even that, there's so much that goes into that lifespan. Like there's some people who once after those first 3 years, they're struggling to stay in the league compared to those who become journeymen. And when you look at journeymen who manage to stay, they're hard hat, lunch pail type of player day in and day out. No system, real cerebral, and then probably not a headache to the front office.
What do you take from that and kind of impress upon your players, right? Obviously, most of the guys who play for you aren't thinking they're going to go to the NBA, but like, what can you distill from that knowledge to say, here's what it takes to kind of impress upon your players in terms of their work ethic or like other messages you can send them?
Yeah, because it's one of those things, just because you see a pro doing a workout on your IG or social media, just because you see somebody doing those drills or working like a pro doesn't mean you're actually working like a pro when it comes to like your rest, your recovery, your nutrition, your study of the games. And you'd be surprised how many young people, at least when they come in, they still have aspirations to play pro and maybe developmental league or overseas or anything like that. But to get to that upper echelon, that's like the 1% of, you know, everybody in that trade of playing basketball. It's like the numbers, I remember you have a better percentage becoming a neurosurgeon or something like that. So it's a reality check. And then for me, it's one of those things, like, what are you going to do when the ball stops bouncing? So what if you have to have a hamstring graft or get a ACL from a cadaver, like I had to do? Like there's a lot that goes into it. And at that age, you know, especially for the younger male minds that aren't fully, frontal lobes not fully developed, like reality in the face, it's like hey, you think you want to be a pro and you're not working like a pro, you're the last one to come to practice, you're the first one out the door. Like you don't stay on top of your treatment when you have a little bit of tendonitis, you're not doing your you work with the strength coach or listening to what the trainers are saying. It's like, if you really want to be a pro and get paid to do this, you have to act like it's a job already in a sense.
Are guys pretty receptive to those conversations? I'm sure it's more maybe than you'd like. You have to have those kind of come to Jesus meetings with guys, right? Like, are they pretty receptive to that?
Depends on what point in time in their in the timeline that they're on. You know, freshman year, usually not. Writing is on the wall. Usually, I think for a lot of players, senior year, like you kind of have an idea like, hey, maybe I do have a chance to go for it and keep playing. Or it's like, wow, I better prepare to get this internship figure out what I want to do. But just, I imagine, like with anything else, since you both are around young people and habits and how they look at things, and like Ben being a professor, you know, at Dominican with me, like I'm sure there's some students who get it and some who don't.
Yep, no doubt.
They're all in Ben's classes. It's basically all of Ben's class. Just doesn't.
All of them just don't. No, that's not true. It's you're right. I mean, I think it is. It's an interesting split. It's almost like it really is kind of dichotomous. Like there's a group who just clearly get it, and there's a group who just clearly don't. And it's always, how do you move the group that don't get it into the category of getting it? And it's hard enough for me. But I mean, you're dealing with, I think, a slightly different subset with guys in athletics, and that's just maybe a slightly different problem to have.
No, yeah. Oh, it is a different problem. Like I said, as far as you know, the group as a whole, like every year, I've always had a great group of guys. I mean, I'd say the biggest thing, like you mentioned, is like some who struggle to understand and comprehend and really show the growth and the movement towards that pendulum, and then the ones who you know are already grounded. So I actually have a great project for you, Dr. Ben. So since you said half your class is that way, so either two things: I got to start sending them to enroll in your class, and then secondly, have you come and pepper our guys with pepper room.
I'd love to, man. That'd be fun. You'll get me out there to clang some shots with the rest of your guys off the rim there too.
that might help. That'll help with our rebounding drill. Since the last year we were in the negative, we were minus, which is not as you can imagine, if you're not shooting a great percentage and getting out rebounded, the analytics will probably show you're not.
This is a show about the result that you want. This is a show about sports psychology. We mentioned empathy. I like the idea of analytics, and I think we spoke briefly earlier about it. You have this program that spits out shooting percentages or whatever it may be about your players and your team. How much of that weighs into what you do? And do you have any statistical advantages compared to your competition? Is there something in terms of analytics that gives Dominican an edge?
Not right now, because like my level division two, like I'm limited in my staff, but if it was one of those things, oh, by far, I'd probably have a young intern or a kid looking at like, okay, every time I wear my lapel of our logo, and then I put this player in this spot on the floor, like what is our percentage? So it's a little more different. It's a little more difficult, but so there's stuff that I use, you know, day in and day out, and then that I see objectively in front day in and day out on, are you really kicking this person's butt in practice, you know, to say that you need minutes, all right? If Brett is our most efficient offensive player according to this, and he's playing this many minutes, and you should play, whose minutes, Ben, should you be taking?
Yeah.
Because there's only five positions on the floor, and there's 200 minutes in this game.
Right.
So you have to be productive, and productive doesn't mean necessarily making points. It means whether you're getting deflections, whether your assist or turnover ratio is there, whether you're rebounding per minute at a high level. Those are things, you know, that I would love to get more into. And I've talked to a couple other Division I coaches who do use that. They enjoy it too. But like I said, unfortunately, like right now, the manpower so not there. So it's a little more difficult. So.
Yeah. We had Reggie Walker on the show like a month or two ago, former NFL player. And he really blew our minds when he said that professional sports is not a meritocracy. It does not matter how good you are. It's politics, right? It's like whoever's closest with the coach. This is going to go on the internet, and I know you can't be completely honest, but like,
I'll shoot you straight.
Yeah, shoot me straight. Like, do you feel like politics is part of it, or like when you look at the analytics and say, look, this guy's got, you know, the best shooting percentage here, this guy here, I got to bench this guy, or do you really feel like there's a subjective pull to the decisions that you make?
Oh, for me, it's subjective. It's one of those things. If you could punt that thing in from 80 feet away on a 90-foot court, I think I'd probably play it because I know what I'm going to get from you. I can see, you know, maybe at those higher levels, like it's one of those things because you got your agent vying for you. Like, hey, we're forking out $5.5 million a year for you to perform. You're part of our ticket sales. They want to come see this person play. Luckily for me, you know, at the college level, it's a little bit different. And I like to think it's still a little bit more one of those things where over time, guys grow into their role. Like, and the thing I tell everybody, like for most scenarios for me, as much as I would love, I probably don't have a blue chipper who's a one and done coming to a division two. It's the reality. But like I said, when you get program guys who are there for 14 years old, my money is that, you know, 18-year-old Brett is going to lose probably most of the time to 22-year-old Brett. After being in the program for 4 years. So for me, it's one of those things like you produce day in and day out in practice. And it's, you know, unequivocal that your teammates know, everybody knows that you're taking that person's minutes or job, or that you should be on the floor. It should be pretty resounding.
So it's pretty meritocratic, right? Like you perform consistently, you're going to get to play.
Oh, for me, yeah, because I don't want the same guy every day. It's not one of those things where, all right, so I have my good lip socks on today. Brett complimented me on those the last two times, and he actually shot 50% in those games. So guess what, Brett? I'm wearing the socks tonight. You're starting.
So consistency is obviously huge to you, right? You mentioned it in terms of your own kind of way you show up for your guys, but then you also expect a certain level of consistency from them. Does that play into your like on floor philosophy at all? Like, do you have a certain way that you like your guys to play? Like you press all the time, or like, is there a certain on floor kind of strategy you like to use?
I think it changes year to year. Cause it's one of those things where as much as I would love, sometimes the talent that you have dictates on what might be efficient. Like if we aren't very deep, I probably want to be selective in how much I press compared to if I was like, okay, we're 10 deep this year. So we're going to go platoon. We're going to go five and five every 3 minutes and just wear teams down and tire you up that way and try to create defensive havoc and get more possessions. Or I might have a group that year where we're not as deep and I want to kind of control the pace of the game. So we, I don't want to say take the air off the ball, but we're more deliberate in what we do. As far as, you know, possessions and taking care of the ball and shot selection compared to one of those teams where maybe you're deeper and you can need to get up more shots. So you have more rebounding opportunities and more chances to get easy baskets and everything like that. And, you know, as far as the consistency part of it, I think as you get on in the season, it becomes a little more clear. Early on, that's always the toughest part. And one of those things in practice where that's why we do stat and try to take stats and kind of break down analytics of what we do have on who should be getting minutes. And then obviously the final box score, usually the picks on whether that was a good choice that night or a bad choice that night. And there has been point in times in games where either one of your players or kid is injured, or maybe he's not just, you know, mentally there, like he's not where his feet are that night, where you're like, hey, Ben, get Booker. Something's wrong tonight, so it's your turn, so you better take advantage of that opportunity. So, and then hopefully maybe you could be Lou Gehrig and take care of Wally Pipp's job.
There you go. Very complimentary. Among everything that I'm sure you're juggling, although you have a tremendous amount of experience, and I think you have tremendous amount of experience with this program as well, being there for 10 years, juggling players, juggling yourself, juggling analytics and staff and everything else going on. This has been a hell of a year, both, you know, the pandemic as well as these issues with social justice that have impacted sports as well. have really reverberated through our lives and obviously, you know, professional sports and I'm sure as well college sports. What's it been like this year? How have you handled that as a coach? Like, what's that been like?
Yeah, I'm kind of like everybody else in a sense. I'm riding the wave, but I'm always like a hopeful person. Unfortunately, there's no playbook for what's going on this year with, you know, COVID and social justice. And it's one of those things where for me, I've been focusing on, you know, what can I do now? Focusing on the task at hand, like whether it's little breaks of trying to stay connected with your team via Zoom, like we did this summer, and check-ins, little FaceTime here and there, which growing up, I was one of those people. I never thought when I first got a cell phone, I was like, I don't want this. People will be able to keep track of me or call me whenever I want. And then now, you know, I find out everybody gets anxiety. It's like, all right, team dinner tonight. All right, everybody put your phones away. And it's like after 15 minutes, like they've all scarfed down their
feet.
They're like, oh, I'm done talking. I just want to talk and then scroll and not make any eye contact. Right now, being able to start workouts, you know, in families and small groups and pods, it has been good. And even one of our players the other night said, like early on, it was really tough. And it's really tough to be away from those guys too, because it happened in the spring. And usually in the spring, you get a lot of time of player development and you can do more, a little more team building with the group that's coming back the next year, so they can kind of set the bar and precedence on what they want the incoming transfers and incoming freshmen to be a part of and fall in line in a sense of what we do. And then with, you know, the social justice and what's going on, you know, being a Black head coach and having players, you know, that are Black and players that are international. We've had players from Serbia, Australia, Sweden, Japan, you name it. It kind of echoes and reverberates like how crazy it is. I have a basketball in the background, but how, like, if you take this ball and I give it to Ben and he passes it to Brett, for some reason... Yeah, exactly. So for some reason, when we share the ball, we wind up having success in scoring the goals or meeting the mark. So it's one of those things where I think it's one of those things that allow me, you know, to connect with somebody, because there's guys on teams who probably wouldn't be hanging out with each other or being exposed to everybody's different background if it hadn't been for the game of basketball. It's amazing what can happen, you know, when you're high-fiving somebody, competing, and of all things, playing a game where you're smiling and enjoying each other, and how much you can get done.
Yeah. Yeah. We've talked about this before on our show, but it seems to me that sports, barring what Reggie Walker said about people being snakes in professional sports, sports are maybe one of the only true meritocracies, right? Like, you get a bunch of guys together who are from different backgrounds, and if you're good, you are going to play and you're going to get the ball, and people aren't going to hesitate to pass it to you if you look differently or you're from a different place, if you're going to know what to do with it once you do get the ball, right? And I think that you hit that so nicely. This sports plays such an important role in combating some of this stuff and really having these conversations that we've been having over the last, you know, many years, but really have become prominent over the last several months.
Yeah, no doubt. Like I said, one of those things, if you're rooming with an international student or somebody from overseas, and how the disco tech music might be different than what I have in my earphones as far as listening to my Run DMC. So I'm aging myself right there saying that. I should probably say a more modern
Drake or some more modern, or
something like that. So that's the unique part about it, like you said. And then, like I said, I know those guys hang out on the weekend with each other, and they open up their homes when they do go home. Like, their parents will be like, oh, if such and such can't go back home during the holidays, come have them stay with us, you know, because it's a long flight to back to Australia or Serbia. So it's that's one of those things where they get to hang out and kind of, you know, learn about each other. And it's always amazing to me to see, whether it's on an airplane flight or a long trip, you know, how guys are any interacting with each other and giddy, especially at the college level, where it's not so business-like, and how, like, you'll be in packed in a 15 passenger van or something like that. And then you see guys knocked out with laying on each other, this and that, and then waking up and just interacting. So that's the beauty of, you know, team and being around each other and all the synergy and chemistry. And the thing about it, like those guys are going to have stories like 20 years from now, you know, they'll have their own families, this and that. And somebody's going to say, oh, you remember that moment when coach wasn't happy. So he rolled the balls out and we had to run our gut busters and championship run. And then Brett was like, I don't think I can see. Help. I got to stop.
Sounds like me.
Yeah, that does sound like you. Well, the cool thing too, Booker, about like what you're talking about is backed up by the research, man. Like there are studies that show that these kinds of experiences that players have on teams together are lifelong, right? And like they carry these lessons with them of like knowing, acknowledging people's differences, but realizing that they aren't meant to split us apart, right? And that they reduce things like prejudice and bias and all this stuff. So it's like you really are doing a true social justice service here by coaching these young men and allowing them to be together in that way.
Yeah, it's something I don't take lightly. Like I know I'm blessed in a great position. And it's one of those things where they're making memories together that they'll never forget. So some days when you're trying to get in shape and in the weight room and then running, it does seem like shared suffering, but it's one of those things where, are you pulling your teammate along with you? Like, Ben, you made me better today just because I was a freshman. And you're like, come on, man, we need you to pull your weight. There's more in you. Or coach saying that to him too. It's like, but I think that's probably the biggest unique thing when you recruit all these guys from different backgrounds and having the vision of how a great team looks like. I know we mentioned a little bit, you know, about like synergy and chemistry on what's that going to look like. Are they running over to pick each other up if they take a charge or there's a loose ball? Are they being positive? Are there still tight huddles when we just had a bad call against us or now we're down three? Like, how's their body language the last minute of the game? Like, are they intent? Do they trust each other? Or is one person going off on his own tangent thinking that he has to save us tonight? You know what I mean?
Right. I don't know if it's your personality or just the experiences you've had, but you just have this warm, like great presence about you. I'm sure your players are lucky to have you. Obviously Dominican is lucky to have you. And we've been lucky to have you today, man. Thanks so much for coming on the show and spending some time with us, imparting some of your knowledge as a coach, as a player, as a human being. Nothing but the best wishes for you, man.
No, thank you so much. It was an honor and a pleasure to be here. Like I said, once I found out that you guys did do a podcast and everything like that, I started cramming and listening to it. I was like, oh, this is not bad. So there's some good stuff and a lot of things for me to, you know, pick and kind of implement on my own that I like, that I think I might work and try. So like I said, it also benefits me. So I'm excited that you guys even thought of me. So especially Ben, you know, working on campus and hey, this is a great thing that you guys are doing.
Thanks. Booker. Well, now you are part of that library.
Yeah. You're in there now, man.
You're on Twitter at Booker T. Harris. Is that true?
That is. So I think that's what I created when I first made it.
Obviously also for those of you that are listening or watching, please rate and subscribe where applicable. Thanks as always to our editing team for putting together today's show. You can find us on Twitter at HeadGamePsych. You can find me on Twitter at Dr. Brett Levine. You can find that guy on Twitter at BD Rosenberg, PhD. And thanks as always for tuning in.